Welcome to a new episode of the Tennis Lifestyle Podcast. I'm Gianluca Sola. In this episode, I chat to Vanni Gibertini. Vanni is a reporter correspondent for ubitennis.com since 2010. He's also a part-time editor. Ubitennis.com is a very popular tennis news website. I recommend it highly. It's very informative and has lots of interesting articles on tennis and news. Vanni is a reporter for ubitennis.com. He lives in Montreal, Canada. He's a freelance sports writer and also an experienced airline professional, having worked in he's got a background, let's say, in aviation, having worked for it. He obviously attends a lot of major tournaments in the world and Grand Slams and Master 1000s, especially in North America, Davis Cup, Fed Cup, and also he reported for the Rio Olympics in 2016. Anyway, in my opinion, he's one of the most informed people in tennis. He always is up to date and up to date with all the news and what's going on. He also has a podcast in Italian, though. It's called Ubi Radio. It was a really nice, relaxed chat. Interesting to find out sort of the life of a tennis journalist, reporter. And don't forget to listen to the mega rapid fire quiz at the end. Thanks for following my podcast. Please also just press that follow button. You'll find me in all the major platforms. And you can follow me also on Instagram, Twitter, and now also on Facebook. I'll put those in the notes to the episode. So I hope you enjoy it. Ciao, ciao. Yes. Hi. How are you?
I'm fine.
Yes. Welcome to the Tennis Lifestyle Podcast. Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You're in Montreal, Canada. How's the day there? Is it a nice day today?
It's okay. I mean, it's a typical May day, I guess. It's not too cold. It's overcast at the moment. I think it's going to be close to 15, 16 degrees Celsius by sort of mid-afternoon. So it's a reasonable day. I mean, we could have snow at this stage on very bad days. So I guess we can't complain.
Okay, so that's a pretty good day. Okay, fantastic. I just want to do a brief introduction. Vanni Gibertini, you can correct me as well. He's a tennis journalist, correspondent for ubitennis.com since 2010, and you are also a part-time editor. You're actually an Italian, which I found out today from Modena, which is actually the same city where I come from, in Italy. But obviously you live in Montreal in Canada. Ubitennis.com is a very popular tennis news website. I actually look at it all the time. And it's, I'm not sure, but I guess it was founded by Umberto Scanagatta. Am I right?
Ubaldo Scanagatta.
Ubaldo Scanagatta. What am I saying? Ubaldo Scanagatta, yeah. We'll talk about him maybe later, but he's quite a legendary Italian commentator, journalist, etc. You're a freelance sports writer, but I also found out you're an experienced airline professional. You've got a background in aviation, and you worked for many years also for the International Air Transport Association.
So far, so good.
And I'm nearly finished. And you're a reporter on site for many major tournaments in the world, including Wimbledon, Grand Slams,
Master Thousands in North America, Davis Cup, Fed Cup, and you did also the 2016 Rio Olympics. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. But anyway, I've been following you on social media, on Ubi Tennis for several years. And in my opinion, that's why I wanted to talk to you. You are one of the most informed people in the tennis world, in my opinion. You're always up to date. I've got very sharp opinions and up to date with the news and all the goings on in tennis. You also have a tennis podcast. You host a tennis podcast called Ubi Radio, but that's in Italian. So obviously for our English listeners, unless you are fluent in Italian, it's going to be a bit difficult. But let's start with you. How did you get into tennis and, let's say, become part of ubitennis.com?
Well, it just happened almost by accident. I guess a lot of people stumble into this business by accident. They start out as fans. You obviously need to like the sport a lot. I've been following tennis since I was 11 years old. I think I started in 1985, watching Wimbledon, the victory run by Boris Becker at Wimbledon. And then I got more and more involved throughout the years. And obviously I liked it and I never stopped. I pursued my career in aviation. I've worked for about 15 years in aviation. That took me around. I went to England in 2001 for my master's degree, and then I stayed there, worked in a few airlines, and then I spent a couple of years in Slovakia, and in 2008 I moved to Montreal to start a job with IATA, as you mentioned at the very beginning. And during this period, I was following tennis, so I started reading Ubi Tennis. They were asking if some of the readers were available to do translations. I can translate from Italian into English because I've been speaking English for so many years, and I've been studying in England. So I think I'm quite proficient. At least back then, I thought I was quite proficient. Now, I hope I am. So, no. I started with that, and then I got a call from Ubaldo and said, "Well, I mean, if you feel like writing, then we can certainly publish your pieces." So I started with a weekly column about travel in tennis, how to travel to the biggest tournaments in the world, because obviously I love traveling, especially by air. So I thought it was a nice way to combine my passion for tennis and my experience as a traveler and my knowledge of aviation. So, and then it all started from there, really. And then I got progressively more and more involved in the work with Ubi Tennis. And then in 2017, I actually became full-time. So, well, I mean, not necessarily full, I'm not full-time part of the editorial team. I do also other things, but essentially this is what I do.
Okay. Let's say it takes up most of your time now. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it certainly does, because following tennis is a very demanding activity. Even as a fan, I mean, anybody who is a tennis fan and wants to follow big tournaments, especially if they don't take place in a convenient time zone, they know that it can be quite demanding on the social schedule and on the working schedule. I mean, when I moved from Europe to the United States, I found it incredibly challenging because the time zone is actually worse. I am in the Eastern time zone. It's actually worse because all the tournaments that take place in Europe, they essentially have all matches during the North American working day. So anybody working a normal office job with a normal office hours would have a hard time following matches live. So you would have to rely on replays, on demand, and so on. Now it's a lot easier than it used to be, even just 10-15 years ago, but still, it is quite demanding. And I mean, during Grand Slam tournaments, your friends will not see much of you.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. Just going back to ubitennis.com, for the people who don't know, but obviously it was founded by Umberto Scanagatta.
Ubaldo.
my God, you know, I grew up with him. I know it's Ubaldo. I don't know why I'm saying Umberto now. Anyway, it's Ubaldo Scanagatta. I'll probably do the whole podcast saying Umberto, but anyway. I would say he's quite a legendary journalist or TV. He also did a lot of TV commentary. When I grew up listening to him, Rino Tomasi and Gianni Clerici, which was actually one of the reasons I actually even got into tennis. They were amazing commentators and made it very interesting. And I would say right now for the international listeners, Scanagatta is more famous for maybe being in the post-match interviews. He's always interviewing the top players and has also had some, let's say, interesting discussions and with, for example, Nadal and Djokovic and so on. How is it working? How is it working for Ubaldo Scanagatta?
Well, it's certainly a very interesting experience. As you said, he is a very flamboyant character. He's known, he's very well known in the tennis circles. Pretty much everyone knows who he is. He's very kind of hot-blooded. I mean, he definitely tells it like it is. He kind of created this character around him. In the post-match interviews, most of the players, they kind of play along. Sometimes there have been moments with misunderstandings, and there has been a need for some clarification with some of the top players. The last one was a couple of years ago at the ATP Finals with Nadal. It was a misunderstanding. The fact is, he's extremely kind of flamboyant, as I said before. And sometimes he just speaks in a very kind of passionate and spontaneous way, and that could actually lead to misunderstandings. In that particular case, it was a lost in translation case. He asked a question to Nadal, who had just gotten married. He used the word marriage, but he actually wanted to ask a question about his wedding ceremony. Now, in Italian, marriage and wedding is the same word, so it doesn't make any difference. In English, they obviously mean two different things. So he used the word marriage instead of wedding. Nadal misunderstood what he wanted to say, actually understood what was said and interpreted in the wrong way. So there was a bit of a spat there, but nothing that couldn't be repaired just a couple of days later with a handshake. It was, sometimes it happens. But it happens everywhere, and this has kind of given him the fame for being the one asking sort of peculiar questions. I mean, pretty sure that if you go on YouTube, you can find quite a lot of his questions being recorded. His exchange with Andy Roddick, for example, very famously during an Australian Open, he got beaten pretty handily in the semifinal by Roger Federer for the nth time. So he went into press conference. Obviously, he wanted to be anywhere but there. And he started answering with like very snappy answers to all the questions by the various news reporters. And then Ubaldo asked him, how much would you have paid not to be here? and then Roddick said, this is probably the best question that has been asked so far. And he came up with it, and he actually started coming up with a decent kind of a reasoned answer. He said, okay, if I just go away, the fine would be like $20,000. So it would obviously be less than that, because otherwise I would have done it. So, but the problem is not being away. It wouldn't be not being in the press conference. It would be about running away. And my dad didn't raise me to run away, so that here I am answering your questions. that was a,
yeah.
That's a very nice exchange. I'm pretty sure you can find it if you look for it on YouTube.
Yeah, no, definitely. There's quite a lot on Ubaldo, not Umberto, Ubaldo Scanagatta. For you, what is the best part of being a tennis correspondent or reporter? I don't know how you want to define it, but is it the travel, the meeting players, interesting people, visiting beautiful places? What's the best part?
But definitely not visiting beautiful places, because we don't visit anything. We spend the entire day between the hotel, the venue, and back. Last year and the year before, actually. Well, last year it was a bit peculiar because of the pandemic. But even in 2019, I went to Roland Garros. And we, especially at both in Roland Garros and at Wimbledon, we tried to stay as close as possible to the venue in order to minimize the commute. So basically, the only Paris that I've seen was the tip of the Eiffel Tower on the taxi coming from the airport going to the place where I was staying, and then the Arc de Triomphe on the way back to the airport. That was my 2 weeks in Paris.
So you know those two things very well. Those two.
I've obviously been to Paris many times. I mean, I've been to Paris before outside the tournament, but if you go for the tournament, you don't really have the time to do much else. I mean, sometimes we try to find some time to do other things, because otherwise you go crazy, especially in other tournaments. Especially if you have some days where there aren't too many matches going on. Wimbledon used to have the middle Sunday. Now, this is going to be the last year with the middle Sunday as of 2022. Yeah. There will be play during the middle Sunday night. During that day, you actually have a day off, so you can actually do normal stuff. Or, for example, in Australia, during the second week, most of the matches take place in the evening. So Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, all matches take place in the evening. So during the day, you have time to do other stuff. At the US Open, the second week is pretty light. So you have some time. For example, on Thursday, normally you have the women's semifinals, and they take place during the evening session. So you start matches only at 7 p.m. So you have time to have a walk around New York if you want to. But we are talking about, you have to struggle to kind of cut out half a day. So if you think that you're going to have a fantastic time, then no, it's not going to happen, especially now, because working for a website, you're always on, you're always live. I mean, people working for the printed press, once the newspaper cutover is gone, then it doesn't really matter what you do. And especially in the United States, unless there is a very important match, if you're writing for an Italian newspaper, and at most you're going to have to file by midnight, if maybe slightly later if you're lucky, that means that by 6:30 p.m. you're done. So if you want to go, if you want to go and watch a musical, or you're going out for dinner in Manhattan, then you can do it.
Okay. No, but my question was, I actually believe you, because you hear often the story of the journalists in the rooms and in the tournaments that are falling asleep. So I believe you totally. My question was, like, what's the best part of your job if you had to choose one?
I guess probably meeting the players and all the people that are actually part of the tennis world. The fact that you get to talk to them in a as normal as possible environment. Obviously, you're not going to go out for dinner with Federer. I mean, that's not going to happen. It used to happen a lot more 30, 40 years ago, when tennis was smaller, there were fewer tennis reporters, and there was no mediation between players and journalists. Now there's the ATP or the WTA. You've got agents, they've got managers, they've got all sorts of people around them, especially the big stars. 30, 40 years ago, according to what I'm told, it was very different. But still, at the same time. Especially for players that maybe they are from the same country as you, that you follow more closely, since the beginning of the career, it's good to actually get to know you and have some kind of rapport with them that goes beyond backhands and forehands. It's important. It's important to start, and it's important both professionally and personally to start talking to players since when they're very young. That's why, for example, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, the second week of Slam is a bit lighter. There are fewer matches, but you also tend to have the junior tournaments, and that's when you want to start the relationship. You want to start the relationship when they are 16, not when they are famous superstars.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, it's a question I wanted to ask you, because I mean I've been involved also a lot in tennis, and you sort of get an idea that people who and players who are in tennis, that's all their life. They do nothing else. They're so immersed in it. It's like nearly a bubble. Would you describe tennis players as interesting people? Are they actually quite interesting? Do they talk about stuff other than tennis?
It depends. It depends on which player. Some of them, most of them, they tend to be a kind of bubble people, because tennis requires a lot of dedication, a lot of commitment. There isn't a lot they can do outside of their work, and it really depends on what kind of people they are. There are some of them that they have all sorts of interests. Like the in the modern tennis, the number one is certainly Miloš Raonic. Miloš Raonic is a very clever guy. He's extremely intelligent. You can speak intelligently about a lot of topics. He's an avid modern art fan. He goes to museums. He goes to art galleries whenever he can. He has bought paintings. He has bought artwork for his own collection. He can speak intelligently about a lot of topics. He's a very, very interesting guy. Riley Opelka as well. He's someone that is very has a lot of kind of passions he's a bit of a foodie. I hear he likes. Okay. He likes good food. He likes art as well. So these people, they certainly are interesting. They certainly are interesting. Okay. On the other hand, you have the tennis guys. I mean, for example, Pete Sampras. It was just tennis. There was nothing else. And that's one of the aspects where he was different from Andre Agassi. That because he kind of was forced into tennis, he really wanted to escape and widen his horizons. So from that point of view, it really depends on the character. Some of those people, they are just tennis. Others, you can talk to them about virtually any topic, and you can have an interesting conversation.
Which makes me just ask you immediately another question. Who's the most interesting tennis player you've met? Who's the most interesting tennis player you've met?
I'd probably say, among those that I know better than average, because obviously you don't get the opportunity to spend a lot of time with most of these people, Matteo Berrettini. Yeah. He's a very peculiar character. I call him the elephant because he remembers everything. He's the kind of person who just remembers matches from, I don't know, 7 years ago. He said, yeah, I played with him. I lost 7-6 in the third. I had match point on 5-4. He really remembers everything. He's very attentive at kind of remembering people's names and acknowledging people. For example, last year at Roland Garros, there were only 1,000 people allowed in during the first rounds, and also during the rest of the tournament. But during the first rounds, you have matches on 15, 16 courts. So you have these 1,000 people spread over a very large area. So he played his first round on Suzanne Lenglen. It's a 10,000 seat stadium. So it's a big stadium. Yeah. And there were probably less than 100 people. So I sat down on the I sat down on one end of the court where the press box was, and he played the match. He won, and then after the match, there was a press conference. So I asked him, before I asked him the question, He looked at me and said, "I saw you today. I saw where you were sitting." Okay. Oh. Now, and I was thinking, why is it relevant where Vanni Gibertini is sitting during a Matteo Berrettini match? Why would he believe that he's relevant? It is relevant. It's because he wants to know what goes on around him. He's okay. Very situationally aware. Okay. And every time you talk to him, you can see that he thinks and he tries to give you the best answer that he can. Ooh. And also, he's been working with a mental coach since very young. He was telling me stories how they have regular meetings. The mental coach is giving him homework, like books to read, movies to watch, and then they discuss about these movies and what they mean, and so on. It's actually quite fulfilling to talk to someone like that, because in a world like tennis, you can be very kind of one-dimensional, and definitely he isn't.
Okay. Now, that's good to know, because I think for people who follow tennis very closely, you often get that that sort of feeling that it can be quite monotonous, but that's nice to know. I'm going to jump a bit all over the place, Vanni. For you, what has been the best tennis experience you've ever had?
The best tennis experience. It's hard to pick one. There were some of the kind of Federer Nadal matches, which is they have a different flavor. I mean, when there is a Federer Nadal match, you kind of have the feeling that it's not the same thing. I mean, the kind of people that you see in the stands are different. Because it's like one of the things that you have to do before you die. Mm. It's like, I mean, some people were saying among the 100 things that you have to do before you die is like watching Federer play. And I kind of keep asking, if you've watched Federer 100 times, does that count with doing all the 100 things? Probably not. Thinking about it, probably, I think if I haven't watched Federer 100 times, probably 98. It's going to be very close. So you have the feeling that when Federer plays, it's something important because of who he is. When there's a Federer Nadal, it's an event. It's a special event, and now it's going to be even more because we don't know how many of those we're going to get. You have the feeling, but probably the most striking experience that I had was a few years ago. Roger Federer had a charity match, the Match for Africa 4. He does work for his foundation. He has charity matches to raise money for his foundation. This match
We just had one here recently in Cape Town.
In Cape Town, yes. Yeah. Okay, I think that was Match for Africa 6. Match for Africa 4 was in Seattle, and he played doubles with Bill Gates. Thank God Bill Gates can't play tennis. He really can't play tennis to save his life, because if he even was good at tennis, then it's quite demoralizing. So apart from that, he played doubles with him, and he played with Isner, and I think, I don't know the name of the other guy. I think he's a guitarist of Iron Maiden. I know he's in a rock band, but I don't know which one. They played this exhibition double, and then they played the singles where they were actually playing for real. And then I was in Seattle by pure coincidence, so I managed to get to go. And the US Open people were actually running the operation from a press point of view. So one of the USTA people, they came over to the press, to the journalist over there, said, "Well, if you want to speak to Roger, we're going to have to do it immediately after the match. So when we are close to the end, I'm going to pick you up and I'm going to take you to the court, and you're going to do the interview in the middle of the court." And that's what happened. The match started to go towards the end. We got picked up. We went courtside. The match was over. Cheers and people shouting and so on. And then we got kind of we got let in, and then we met Federer in the middle of the court. It was basically on the service line, and we could see all the people around the court. So you could, I was sitting there and I was just looking 360 degrees around me, and I was seeing people shouting, wanting autographs, and calling his name. And I was thinking, this is his life. This is what he experiences every single time he goes on court, every single time he kind of puts his nose outside of the house. Yeah. This is what happens to him every time. And it was quite an experience. Being in the middle of everything, it definitely is an experience.
Okay. Well, amazing. Yeah. Okay. Vanni, I wanted to also talk to you. Now we're completely going to change topic. But I wanted to talk to you also. You've done quite a few podcasts lately on the present state of tennis, let's call it that. And, you know, I think this is a discussion that could be, I mean, we could talk maybe for 10 podcasts forever. So it might end up being quite general. But I find it, I find that tennis right now, don't know if you agree, is in a very kind of sort of critical moment. I don't know if professional tennis can continue the way it is now. We know that tennis is one of the most popular sports in the world. You have men, women playing, all ages. It's one of the most played sports. Yet it seems like it's losing fans, and the TV viewership is very small compared to other sports. So it going forward into the future, the sport of tennis has a lot of challenges. What do you think, and this is, as I said, this is a very long discussion, but what do you think must be done to make tennis more appealing right now and to attract new fans, if you had to pick a few things?
Obviously, this topic has been debated, especially very recently. The ATP CEO, Andrea Gaudenzi, has a very strong opinion about what needs to be done. He has presented his manifesto that is kind of leading into a certain direction. And I think he has pinpointed the right problem. Unfortunately, the way it is working right now, it's difficult to sustain because it's extremely top heavy. Yeah. A lot of money and a lot of resources go to a very small percentage of the top players, of the top events, of top coaches, of the top everything. So if you're not in the elite, in the crème de la crème, then it's a very difficult sport to actually have as a viable business. So I mean, in terms of tournaments, most of the money is in the Grand Slams, and those four tournaments that are independent from the rest of the tour, they are essentially islands, and they can function independently without having to ask much to anyone apart from themselves. They have created the Grand Slam board. So the four Grand Slam tournaments, they have a board, and they essentially agree on what needs to happen. And so they make sure that neither of them kind of goes astray and does their own thing. Now, this has its own challenges because this could be prone to investigation from antitrust authorities. So they have to make sure that this isn't something that is going to happen. However, most of the money is there. From a player's point of view, the top players are multimillionaires, and the number 150 probably doesn't break even by the end of the year. It's extremely complicated. The issue is that of revenue redistribution, and that is the same issue that many countries face. And there are different philosophies, and there are different theories about it. Now, there is one issue that needs to be approached and needs to be fixed, because otherwise, you're not going to have tennis. You're not going to have a tour or a circuit. You're going to have an exhibition, a circus, like I don't know, who was the guy? I don't remember the guy who.
More time.
No,
No.
no, no, no.
No.
The one, the American player that actually turned pro, and that created the and they created the pro tour, where most of the players were actually joining, leaving the amateur status and becoming pro. Anyway, so
Okay.
basically, because I mean, one thing that I've said many times, at the moment, organizing a 250 event costs more or less like organizing a kind of a four player exhibition with a few top 15 players. The problem is that if you do the exhibition, you probably make 10 times the money that you do with the ATP 250. So obviously the money would naturally go there, but if you only do exhibition with the top players, then you don't have a circuit, you don't have anything. It's not a professional sport.
There's way too many problems. As far as I'm concerned, there's too many issues, too many problems, and it's something that I think they have to start doing one thing at a time, basically, because there's too many issues. I mean, I'm just talking out of my experience, and I have two teenage boys, 16 and 17, and they both play tennis and they love playing tennis. I'm just giving an example. But they don't watch tennis. And trust me, everybody in their age group, and I would say probably up to 30 years old, don't watch tennis, or very few of them do. This new generation, obviously, there's all the technology, there's all the new entertainment, there's all everything is on demand immediately. The tennis, the way it's structured and done now, is going to struggle tremendously going forward. And I think Gaudenzi, for example, talked about this and he's aware of this. And so I think there's two things. One, it's the, I don't know if you agree, but one is the obviously the format of tennis might have to change. And secondly, and that is to make it more quicker and to make it easier to follow, to have times that are times of the tournaments that you already know when they are playing. There's a lot of things there. And then the second thing is obviously it's too you've got too many entities. You've got seven entities basically, or you've got the ATP, WTA, ITF, and you've got all the slams. So it's very confusing for everyone, especially for a new person coming into tennis. What do you think of the format of tennis? I'll give you quickly my opinion, but I'm somebody who can watch tennis all day in its current format, and I love best of five sets. I mean, that's just me. But I think the format must be changed, maybe for all the tournaments except the Grand Slams. The Grand Slams must stay the same, but the ATP tour must have a format where there's no deuce, there's no warm up, there's no let, and there's no medical timeout. You must have a medical timeout on changeover. That's as simple as that. I mean, I know that's
It's quite radical, yeah.
quite radical, but if you want to make it quicker, I would start with that. And okay, still best of three sets. And I would maybe even look at it if you're doing the Masters 1000s or even all the other tournaments, you do that format. But then when you get to the final, you do a better best of five sets. I don't know. That's just my idea that I've been thinking of. But I mean, what's your opinion on that?
In terms of the format of how the score should work and how matches should play out, I'm a bit more of a traditionalist because I think we need to make sure that we don't throw away the baby with the dirty water. Tennis kind of works very well from a certain point of view, and I'm okay with the no let. I mean, I don't think that changes too much. I don't really like the no ad because that's the core of the game. It really changes a lot how matches play out if you have the no ad if you have the decisive point at the end of the game. That really changes the nature of the game. I don't really. I'm actually okay with the match tiebreak. I like the idea of the match tiebreak. That is something that I would consider if you really need to shorten matches. I would work mainly on packaging. I would work mainly on the storytelling. Like Andrea Gaudenzi says, he says tennis needs to compete not only with other sports, it needs to compete with Netflix, it needs to compete with Hulu, it needs to compete with HBO, it needs to compete with PlayStation.
Games. With many things.
So it's more about storytelling to make the story compelling. I mean, there are lots of initiatives that can be done. For example, Formula One had a huge success with their Netflix series. That Netflix series was a very big hit among non-core fans, and still they managed to do it even. Being quite faithful to the technicalities of the sport. But from a, I mean, I actually mentioned this in one of my podcasts a few weeks ago. I really like the idea that CBS launched last January during the NFL playoffs. In the United States, the NFL is the biggest league that they have. Enormous resources at their disposal. They've just renewed their TV rights deal. They're going to get paid $10 billion a year for the next 11 years. So they're going to have $110 billion to actually play with. So, but anyway, what they did is during some of the games that they were broadcasting, they had a simulcast, meaning that they were broadcasting the game on CBS like normal, but they were simulcasting the game, so live at the same time on Nickelodeon. Nickelodeon is a channel that is mainly targeted to children. On Nickelodeon, they were dressing the game with what children wants to see. There was SpongeBob SquarePants that was giving the score. There was young Sheldon that was explaining the rules of football. There were three commentators behind a DJ desk that were actually explaining what was happening during the game. And then you had all the special effects on the screen. That is a way of telling the story in a way that your audience can actually receive it. If you want to have someone in top hat and monocle talk to 15-year-olds, they're not going to succeed. You need to speak their language. But it doesn't mean that you have to change the game, because the game was always the same. The game was exactly the same that was broadcast on ESPN for sports fans or on CBS for the general public. They were dressing it differently.
I actually think that's very smart. I agree with you. I mean, and at the same time, I'm not saying I'm somebody who likes the way tennis is like it is right now and the format and everything. But to get the new generation involved, I guess that's a very good way to go about it. It might take a bit of time. I still think maybe something has to be changed. But yeah, maybe it doesn't have to be that radical. But that's an interesting. It's interesting what you're mentioning, because I'm actually going to be interviewing a coach soon, who approaches the way of coaching tennis just like that. So he's going to dress up, and he has like Barney, whatever, you know, instead of all these high performance academies that, you know, everybody's going to be the next Nadal, and so everybody must train this way, you know. So anyway, I'm going a bit off topic there, but so that's quite interesting. But do you think they will be able to make less entities, so combine the ATP, the WTA? Do you think that's going to happen?
I'm a bit of a pessimist from that point of view. I don't think it's going to happen organically. I think if it happens, it's going to have to happen in a traumatic way, mainly because there are too many people with a vested interest for things not to change. If you have seven entities, you have seven CEOs, you have seven CFOs, you have seven directors, seven managers, And if those entities were to be combined, then those seven CEOs would have to become one. And six people will either have to lose their job or become less important. And these people will do whatever it takes to make sure that that doesn't happen. I don't see how these people are just going to decide, yeah, I'm going to take a pay cut for the greater good of the game. I don't think that's going to happen.
So Gaudenzi has got a very tough job ahead.
or he may be the one that is going to be replaced. I mean, just because he's taken the lead, it doesn't mean that he's going to be the one at the in front of the army when we come to the battlefield. He's had a vision. He has a vision. He definitely has a vision, and he's not afraid to show it.
Yeah.
Whether he's going to be able to succeed, that's a different kettle of fish. And I mean, his vision stops way short of saying we need all to be together. The idea is we need all to work together, which is a different thing. So
yeah.
I mean, if you actually look at the sports that work in the best possible way, you have one entity very strong, very well funded, that is managing the sport. Just look at Formula One, the NFL itself, UFC. UFC, they've managed to create a fantastic environment in Yas Island to have their fights even during the pandemic. But obviously, in order to do that, you need to change the business model. I mean, I've been saying this repeatedly during the last year. There were many fans that were sending messages through the website Ubi Tennis on social media. We have weekly live broadcast on Facebook with my colleague Luca Baldissera, and everybody was saying, why has Formula One restarted and tennis is still lagging behind? Things are back to normal. And I was saying, no, things are not back to normal. The problem is the business model. Okay, the sports that did manage to restart very quickly were those sports that, first of all, they had a lot of revenue coming from TV deals.
Yeah.
And secondly, they were the ones that were prepared to spend a lot in order to create the bubbles and in order to go ahead because they knew they had the money from the TV deals. Unfortunately, tennis doesn't work that way. Even Grand Slams get at most 40-45% of their revenues from TV. They need people on the stand. And
the corporate as well.
Is exactly. Yeah. One component that is very important for tennis is corporate entertainment. Tennis is very conducive to corporate entertainment because it lasts very long. It's a day out in a very nice place, so you can take your guests and then you can feed them and then you can wine them and then they can watch some tennis and then they can drink some more. It's very good for corporate entertainment, and those revenues are extremely important for tournaments, both the slams and other tournaments and minor tournaments. If you have a 250, the TV at best is going to account for 10-15% of your revenues. Anything else is local sponsorships, corporate entertainment, and the ticket booth.
So, are you, you might be a bit pessimistic going forward?
No, I say I don't see how the seven entities are going to become one, or even three. I mean, I think they're probably here to stay. So we need to find a way that we're going to work together, and that in order to work together, there needs to be a solution that is a win-win-win seven times. Everybody need to believe they're getting something out of the solution. If someone believes they're getting screwed, they are not going to play ball.
Perfect. There was another question, but I think that's also another long discussion. The prize money, you know, but I don't think I want to go there. But I'm already keeping you a long time. I actually usually end my podcast with a rapid fire quiz. Would you like to Are you ready for that? And you can also elaborate if you want to. What is your very first memory of tennis?
As a player, as a kind of a watcher?
Can be anything. Yeah.
I do believe tennis on TV. I watched a match on TV, and I couldn't understand how it worked. The reason why I got into tennis is because the rules are complicated. I couldn't understand when a point actually ended, because I didn't know what the lines actually meant. I mean, when the ball was going in the tram lines, they were calling it out and said, "But that's the court. It doesn't matter. There's a line in the middle, but that's the court." And then when they were serving, I saw a ball in the middle of the court, and they were calling it out. And I thought, "It's in the middle of the court. How can it be out?" So that's what got me into tennis. And I think I saw a match on TV, and I didn't understand anything of it. And the things I don't understand, things that I don't understand, actually attract me, because I want to understand them.
Okay. Define to us what type of player you are, tennis player.
Me, I'm a kind of a baseline ball basher. I mean, I'd say I would probably, when I was starting to play, I was getting inspired by Jennifer Capriati. I mean, that kind of player.
Okay. Well, that was my next question. If you had to choose a pro that resembles your game, would it be like Jennifer Capriati?
Yes, okay. I would say so, yes.
Okay. Best shot?
My best shot? Probably the forehand.
Okay. Tennis idol growing up?
Ivan Lendl.
Current favorite player, male or female?
I can't say that. I was a Federer fan before I actually became involved in tennis. But now you can't be a fan of someone. I mean, unfortunately, he's been playing for so long that he has defeated time, at least until now. But obviously, from a purely selfish point of view, I like Italian players to do well, because Italian players do well, we get more airtime on media. So it's just a selfish reason.
Okay. All right. No, that's fine. You'll enjoy this question then. List the big three from favorite to least favorite.
The list of big three from favorite to least favorite.
Yes.
I'd say Federer, Nadal, Djokovic.
Is there a best match you have ever seen? It can even be a club match, like at your local club.
The match that I enjoyed the most in terms of how they played, probably just because it was one of the first, when I was at university, I took my first trip to the United States, and I went to see the Davis Cup semifinal. That was the United States against Australia in Washington, D.C., and the third singles rubber was Pete Sampras and Pat Rafter. Sampras and Pat Rafter. I mean, the especially the first two sets, third and fourth, were a bit lopsided, but the first two sets, they were extraordinary. I mean, they played magnificent tennis that you don't see any longer, because it was serve and volley essentially every point. So it was a different tennis, but they played very, very well. That was it. And then, I mean, there was the Federer Nadal at Wimbledon in 2019. There was the Federer Nadal in Australia in 2017, although I saw only a part of it. In outside slams, I would say Federer Kyrgios in Miami in 2017. That was a great
match. That was a good match, best tournament in the world?
Indian Wells. Without any hesitation.
Yeah, it's one of my bucket lists. Favorite surface?
Favorite surface?
To play and to watch.
Okay. To watch, I really like hard courts. Hard courts, not too slow. To play, if it's not too slippery, Green clay is actually quite good because it's not too bad on your knees. But sometimes it gets slippery. But yeah, I actually like playing on green clay because it's not too bad.
Do you get quite a bit of that in Canada
Yeah, we
or
do. Yes, we do. I mean, unfortunately, we play tennis like 4 months a year, unless it's indoor. But yeah, I mean, I mean, the tennis season normally goes from May to October when you're lucky. Now, May, it's very rare that you're going to be able to start playing at the beginning of May. Now
but I
we're
mean
lucky. Now we are lucky because we can actually play outdoor.
but I imagine you've got a lot of indoor courts there.
Not too many. I mean, t tennis is quite
Really?
expensive in Canada. Tennis is quite
Okay.
expensive. I mean, in Montreal, we are lucky because there's a tennis federation. The tennis federation is based here. The development center is here. They have a big indoor facility, and as part of their statute, it is stated that it has to be dedicated mainly, more than 50%, to the community playing tennis. So even the
Okay.
players who are on the professional on the professional track, they actually have to book courts. I was talking to some of the coaches at Tennis Canada. They have to make sure that their courts are blocked off for their training sessions because they are normally always booked, completely
Okay.
booked, morning to evening, and they have to be dedicated more than 50% to the community. But
Okay.
apart from that, if you go to, I mean, a private club with indoor courts is something, it is extremely expensive in Canada.
All right. What is your, do you have a favorite all-time tennis racket?
Favorite all-time tennis racket? I think it would have to be the Babolat Pure Drive because of what it means. In terms of rackets that have a special meaning for me, I'll probably have to go back to the Prince Graphite 110, the
Definitely.
one that Chang used, or the Dunlop Max 200G, the one
Yeah.
that Steffi Graf used for the Grand Slam in 1988, or
Sort of
John McEnroe. Okay.
my era as well. Yeah. I think those were how do you say legendary rackets really. This one's quite nice. You have to book a restaurant and invite free players. It can be any players, male, female, of any era. Which restaurant and players do you invite?
Okay, players first. Naomi Osaka, that's for sure.
Okay. Are you a big
Steph,
fan of Naomi Osaka?
I mean, I like the way that she's behaving. I mean, I think it is what women's tennis needed. Women's
Okay.
tennis needs a character, needs someone that needs to transcend the sport, someone that can be mainstream. She will be hosting the Met Gala. I mean, if that is not being mainstream, then I don't know what is. The tennis needs
Okay.
someone that gets invited to the Oscar parties. They need
Yeah.
someone like that. They need Serena Williams and Maria Sharapova. Maria Sharapova is gone. Serena is not very far, so we need somebody to replace them. Naomi Osaka is there. Hopefully, we can get someone else. For example,
Okay.
I've always said that I'm not too keen on Ashleigh Barty being number one in the world, not because she's not a good tennis player, she's a fantastic tennis player, but she's not a character. She's not someone that will transcend the world of sport because of the way
Okay.
she is. I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing. She is like that.
Yeah.
So, but it's
Yeah,
not
sure.
necessarily what tennis needs to
Yeah.
pro WTA tennis needs to promote women's tennis. But anyway, back to the restaurant.
Yeah.
Naomi
Naomi
Osaka,
Osaka.
Steffi Graf. I probably need a player. A
I was
player.
going to say all women.
Yeah, no, I need. Of course, I mean a double couple. Okay, will I have Roger Federer? I mean, it is. It may not be. It may not be very creative, but it is someone who's going to. Is definitely going to say something interesting. So there, in terms of the restaurant, I'll probably let them choose because they know restaurants way more than I do. Maybe I'd go to a sushi restaurant just because, and I'd let Osaka choose because I'm pretty sure that she would choose well.
She knows her sushi. Do you like cooking?
I like more cooking than cleaning up afterwards. I don't I kind of before I start cooking, I kind of think of all the pots and dishes that I will have to wash up afterwards. So I kind of get discouraged. I mean, I'm not a great cook, but I mean, I guess being Italian probably makes me a better cook than the average in Canada. So you can live off that.
Favorite food?
Favorite food? Yeah, we have to go with pizza. I mean, the real one, the one they created in Naples, yes.
Favorite pizza topping?
Favorite pizza topping?
Or favorite pizza?
Favorite pizza, I'd say Parma ham and mushrooms.
Okay, that's quite unusual. Okay. Okay, no, great. Do you have any particular hobbies, or is it like aviation and tennis, which is already a lot, to be honest?
It's yeah, it is a lot, yes. No, I don't really have any particular hobbies, but nothing that would take up a lot of my time, mainly because I mean I don't watch too much TV. Well, apart from all the sports that I watch. My other sport, I mean, I like several sports. I got involved in volleyball when I was much younger because in my hometown, and volleyball is a bit of a religion. I was a volleyball referee for over 10 years. I actually took part to some of the events like Champions League matches or Champions League finals and so on. So I keep following volleyball because that's my first love. And so that's one thing. I like Formula One because it was one of the very few things that I did with my dad. Yeah, apart from that, no, I don't really have any other serious hobbies, no.
A lot of tennis players are superstitious. Are you superstitious?
No, it's just too
No.
it's too draining. Being superstitious is too draining. I mean, you have to pay attention to so many things. It's just not it's not not it's not healthy. And some of them it's not about being superstitious, it's about sticking to a routine. I mean, for example, all the things that Nadal does before going on court and when on court, if he were to lose 40 matches in a row, he would still keep doing the same things and believe that that's the best way of doing it. So I think that it goes beyond superstition.
But he doesn't lose 40 matches in a row, so
Well, okay,
maybe that's why
that's
he
just an accident. It's just an
doesn't.
accident.
How many hours do you sleep on average?
It really depends, because I tend to have a fairly good sleep routine. I would probably go on 6 or 7. I'm not the kind of people who needs to sleep 8, 10 hours. I can't be asleep for that long. In fact, I'm desperately envious of people who sleep that much, especially on planes. I don't sleep on planes. I've given up.
Impossible.
And but the problem is I've seen people kind of sleep 12 hours on a plane. I mean, I can't sleep 12 hours in a bed, let alone on a plane. So I can't do it. So I tend to get restless after a while. So no, I stick to 6 or 7.
Favorite country in the world?
United States, unfortunately, because that's it's something that it's a country that would give you a lot of disappointments, but I do believe that it has the most potential.
Okay. Favorite city?
Favorite city? It's funny. Probably LA, probably Los Angeles.
Oh,
Probably Los
okay. That's
Angeles.
quite.
Yeah, although the first time I went there, I didn't like it at all. But the more I kept going there, every time I was landing, I felt like I was home. For some reason, it felt comfortable. It felt like this is the place where I'm supposed to be.
Okay, nice. It is a very, I've actually lived there for a bit. It's a very nice city. Is tennis the most difficult sport in the world?
No, there must be more complicated. But I mean, cricket, I cannot get. And I honestly, when I hear cricket reports, it's like Chinese. They speak a language that I cannot understand. I mean, there's if even if when they're talking about the sports that you don't necessarily know, okay. I don't know. I'm not it, but I don't know rugby that well. I mean, I may watch a few matches, but I don't know it that well. Or I don't know taekwondo. But you can still follow. Cricket is just a different planet. They use all these different these words, and then there's a team that goes ahead like 250 points, and then they come back. It's like snooker. I don't know. It's something that it really excuse my reasoning capabilities. No.
Cricket. Okay. I'm going to give you a shot. You must give me a name. It can be male, female, any era.
Okay.
Serve.
Pete Sampras.
Return.
Agassi,
Forehand.
Del Potro,
Backhand.
I keep Agassi,
Okay. Volley.
Edberg,
Drop shot.
Martina Hingis,
Okay. Movement.
movement. Guillermo Coria, I'd say.
Okay, that's interesting. Mental toughness.
Nadal, there is no question.
I think Nadal's 99% of the people I ask. Touch, feel.
Between McEnroe and Federer.
Okay. And presence, aura.
Federer, there is no question that he's Federer.
Federer, yeah.
I mean, with my colleague Luca, we have a joke that says, "Well, when a player plays Federer for the first time, he has to pay the Federer tax. That's a set and a break. So basically, it takes a set and a break before you actually get over the fact that you're playing Federer. Okay, then you have to see if you can, if you are good enough to kind of catch up." But the Federer tax is very heavy, and it tends to
You have
be,
to
yeah.
pay it.
I mean,
Yeah,
I can,
no.
and I can understand that because, and I have to say, I try to be very respectful of everything that happens like in those circumstances. I actually see it often, and I try to be very mindful of it. Whenever Federer plays, I actually know that there are a lot of people in the stadium for whom that's the pinnacle of their tennis fan's career. That's the moment they've been working on for, I don't know, years. That, and maybe for me, it's just another day at the office. But I try to be very mindful that for them, it's very important. And I think Federer knows, and is kind of very mindful too. And that's one of the things that makes him the great player that he is. He definitely knows about that, and not only him, also Nadal and Djokovic. From that point of view, they are very mindful of what they actually may mean to some people.
No, yeah, that definitely. I'm not sure about Djokovic, but Nadal, Federer, definitely. And but I don't know. I don't know. But yeah, that's it. I have a final question which I've stolen from somebody who you'll know, but I've stolen it anyway. It's ask yourself a question and answer
Well,
it.
ask myself a
And
question and answer
it doesn't have to be serious.
it.
It
Doesn't
can
have
be
to
any.
be.
It doesn't have to be serious. It can be any question.
That's very difficult because it's like when they give you an essay to write, and they say write about everything you want, and then it takes you like it takes you ages to think about what you want to write. That's just too tough.
We can skip it. It doesn't
Yeah, I mean,
matter.
it's now I'm under pressure. Now I'm under pressure because I mean, you should have given me a kind of advance warning. I would have thought about it.
It's fine. Don't worry. Okay. No, it's fine. Maybe next time.
Okay.
Or I'll put it in the show notes. You can send me
Okay.
a But no, that's it. I really enjoyed it. I didn't really know you that well, but it was a pleasure talking to you. And I mean, I think the topics we discussed, we can talk forever. And but it was very nice. And thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Okay, Vanni, have a great day,
Same to
and
you.
hopefully speak to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Okay, ciao, ciao, bye-bye.